Hello everyone. My name is Jussi-Pekka Palko and I'm a legal counsel here at the University of Jyväskylä. And today I will give you a presentation on the project agreement that you will sign during your project work and also about copyrights quite briefly. So a little bit about myself. So I mainly work on legal issues related to research, and especially research contracts, and also to intellectual property to some extent, mostly copyright issues. So first I will talk briefly about copyrights, and then I will go through the main point of today, which is the project agreement, and I will go through the most relevant sections for you that you should be aware of before you sign anything. Okay. So let's start really briefly on intellectual property. You might be actually familiar with these issues, but just some basic things for background. So we usually talk about IP or IPR, and the R translates to rights. So we talk about the rights to property. So traditionally we have the ownership of physical objects, but in the case of IPR, we talk about something that is not physical, something that's not tangible, not in the physical world. So usually these IPRs, they are divided into two parts. So copyrights is the first part, and then the industrial rights the second. And these industrial rights, they include things like patents, trademarks, and utility models and designs, etc. But today the main focus will be on copyrights, and that's probably something that you already have some kind of a idea about, but it's good to repeat some of those. So in Finland, this copyright is governed by the Copyright Act as the legislation, although there's some EU level harmonization on this issue. But first about the scope of copyright. So in general, the protection is quite wide, and it mainly protects literary or artistic works, and pretty much anything related to that. So here's a list of different types of works, such as a thesis, a speech, a poem, a novel, a painting, a drawing software, a composition, etc., etc. And one thing to note too is actually that the artistic quality of these works is not that important. So work can be quite terrible, but you still get protection for it if you made it yourself. So, and the protection for a copyright is automatic, so you don't need to register the copyright. You just have to create the work, and that's enough. And the scope of protection is 70 years from the death of the author, so it's quite a long time that protection is given. And a little note about some related rights to copyright that also get protection, such as normal photographs, databases, and performing artists' rights. So kind of a technically different type of protection, but those are also included in the scope of protection. So what does copyright actually protect? So it generally protects the form of expression and not the ideas or the information themselves. So these ideas have to be actually manifested in usually in a physical sense. So you have to express the ideas somehow so that you can get protection for your work. For example, you write something down, and that way you will get protection. There are also two criteria in the law for protection. Firstly, there's the independency, and secondly, originality. So this originality means that there needs to be some kind of creativity in the process of making it. So creative choices have to have been made for the work to be original. And secondly, the independency. So that kind of mean that the work has to be independent enough so that if somebody else did exactly the same work, it would be different in the way that work is expressed. And well, this kind of depends on the type of work, if it gets protection. But usually, for example, a literary, a written work can get protection really easily. And the threshold for giving protection for written work is really low. And what does copyright not protect? So here's a list of things. Like I said, ideas or information themselves are not protected. Scientific theories, methods, terms, for example, the plot of a novel or a film, they are not protected. Innovations are usually protected through other means, for example, patents, and so logic, algorithms, mathematical formulas are not protected. So who owns the work? So as a starting point, the work belongs to a natural person who created the work, and that's called the creator. So it doesn't automatically belong to any other person who may have somehow contributed to the creation, for example, a technical assistant or legal persons. Legal persons could be, for example, the employer or a financier or something like that. So the natural person is the owner as a starting point. But naturally, it is often agreed in a contract that some rights, they are transferred to a legal person, for example, to an employer. So for instance, here at the university, the employees often transfer their rights to certain scientific output that are financed by an external legal person. And also, if there are actually many creators, then the work belongs to every one of them equally, if the parts of the work cannot be distinguished or divided clearly. So it's equal ownership. And software is actually something that is an exception to this, and they can be quite problematic to some extent. Often, for example, if software was created as an employee, it might belong to the employer in that case. And then about the rights that the owner of the work gets. So there are economic rights and moral rights. Firstly, about economic. So these include reproduction rights, which means that you have the right to make copies, with limitations, of course, and also publishing rights. And that means making the work available to the public and circulating the work. And of course, these rights can be fully transferred, these economic rights, unlike moral rights. Licenses can be granted to other people that might utilize the work. And if you want to modify somebody else's copyrighted work, that requires permission in that sense. And then about moral rights. This also belongs to the creator of the work, and these include the right to be recognized as a creator. So if you present the work, you should acknowledge the creator and not, for example, take credit for yourself or another person's work. So that is included in the moral rights sense. And also the work may not be altered in a prejudicial way, which basically means that you you cannot change or present the work in a negative way that harms the creator. And these moral rights, unlike economic rights, cannot be transferred fully. Now, but the restrictions to the rights of the owner. So first of all, there's the right to quote. I mean, these restrictions, they limit the rights of the owner of the work. And the first one is the right to quote. If somebody else quotes your work, that of course can be seen as a limitation to the your copyright. So this right to quote is very, very important in scientific research, so other people can make citations of your work. So, for example, they can take a passage from a book that you can use freely, of course with certain conditions. For example, you have to mention the source and the author. And like I said, it's for research purposes. That's really important for the researchers to actually, and students also, to utilize other people's output. There are certain good practices that need to be followed. Like I said, mentioning the source and not using the whole work. You can't quote the whole book or take a whole film and present it. You can take a clip of it in certain senses. And to quote, the work needs to be published. And naturally, as students, you should be aware that plagiarism is not allowed. And other restrictions to copyright, so private copying. So generally, you can copy a work for private use, but the work needs to be published beforehand, of course, and so you can't exploit the work commercially. So only for private use. There are of course exceptions to this, such as software or database issues, but those are more technical for this presentation. And like I said, for example, only for study purposes, the private use is only allowed for that and not for business purposes. Some concluding random notes about copyright. So maybe you'll find this useful. Creative Commons is something that refers to these licenses that creators can give out and can, for example, give other people free right to use your work. And people who utilize these licenses, they can, for example, write the paper and license it with these CC licenses. And they can kind of decide how they want to give the right to use the work. So, for example, they can give everyone else the right to use your work, but prohibit the modifications of that work. So there are quite a few different kinds of licenses that can be used. And the last point, joint works. So if there are copyright protected works that were created by many creators and their contributions cannot be separated, then the permission to use is required from all these authors. And often in these cases, the management of this joint ownership, they are done through agreements. And as you will find out with the project agreement, pretty much anything can be agreed in agreements related to copyrights. Okay, so now about the most important part of this presentation, which is this project agreement. So I will briefly talk about the agreement generally and a little bit about contractual issues, and then I will go through the most relevant parts of the agreement section by section. So why even make a written agreement? So of course, this the purpose of these contracts is to define the rights and obligations and the responsibilities of the parties. So by signing an agreement, you establish a legal relationship between the parties, and of course, agreements should generally be written agreements, especially if you're agreeing on something that is important, that establishes rights, for example, in an economical sense. So it's kind of hard to go in front of a judge and explain that you had an agreement, which was an oral agreement, but you don't have anything to show for it. So always write and sign an written agreement. So about the rights and responsibilities, so there's this old contractual principle that agreements must be kept. It's pacta sunt servanda in Latin. So it's a fundamental contractual principle, and that you have to honor the agreement. And in case of a breach, there are usually consequences for that breach. And usually it is liability for damages, but I'll talk about liability a bit later. So let's get into this contract in question. So there's a template that is usually used for these project agreements, and it's proven to be quite acceptable and good template. Usually, when parties are doing contractual negotiations, they use the templates such as this. So it kind of forms the basis for negotiations. So often one party sends the other party a template for an agreement, and then the parties go back and forth with suggestions and comments on the contract. You know, if they have a problem with something or something to add or change in the contract, so templates are usually used. So here's the structure of the contract. So first of all, there are the parties, which in this case are the student. Students and the university and the company, and in this case, I think there are two educational institutions, not only the university. So it's a three-party agreement, pretty straightforward. And in this case, when there are many students that are parties to the agreement, it's good to note that every student is individually responsible for their part of the agreement and their obligations, and there's no collective responsibility for others. So it basically means that you generally only answer for yourself in the agreement and for your own actions. And also something to note is that only a party to the agreement, somebody who has signed the contract, they can make claims in relation to the contract. So about the structure, I will go through all of these in a bit, but there's the purpose and the background, the assignment, obligations, payments, confidential information, background and results, guarantee and maintenance, liability, term of the contract, possible changes to the contract, and applicable legislation. So first, the purpose and the background. So this is only the part where there are general information about the contents of the contract. So what exactly are we doing here, and why are we signing this contract, and that sort of things. So often the background is it's a general overview of the situation. Kind of helps the parties to understand other clauses and what they are agreeing to. And in what context? So anyone who reads the agreement, they can better have the big picture of the contract. So in this case, in this project agreement, the background includes some things about your course and why are you doing this assignment and why this agreement is made. So just for you to understand. And the second part of is the assignment or the project proposal, and generally it's a description of the project, and you probably know what that is already. So in this case, it's an annex to the actual contract that's it's made separately. And well, the proposal is quite important for the contract, because it actually sets out what you will do during the project period, and what is expected of you and your responsibilities and obligations, and also the rights that you have. Often these proposals, they work as the basis for the also for the negotiations of the parties. So the next section is obligations, and this section is divided into three parts. So every party's obligations are discussed separately. In this part, it states the general obligations, what each of the parties needs to do to fulfill the agreement on their part. For example, the educational institutions and the clients, they need to provide certain guidance during the project to the project groups. And on the other hand, the project group has to make a project plan and carry out the project according to that plan. And about these obligations, they generally need to be written quite clearly, so that the parties can actually understand what they are agreeing to, and so that there's no confusion to the about the what must be done during the project. So in that sense, it's also important that you understand what exactly you are agreeing to, and if you don't understand something, you should ask for clarifications, or generally just ask if there's anything that is confusing, or yeah. And the next part is payments. Pretty straightforward stuff. So usually this part includes what is being paid, and the conditions, how the payments are made, and when and how, and if there are any other costs related to this. So in this agreement, there's a clause that the client pays a certain amount to the university after the project results are handed out. And it also states there's a possibility of compensation for the project group if there's a special significance of the results financially. But this is something that is negotiated separately. And also, the section states that the client has the obligation to compensate certain expenses to the group, and this includes something like travel expenses and other that type of costs. So this part is quite important. So this is confidential information. So the clause in this contract is really a standard confidentiality clause, and firstly, the scope of it's defined as something. It's pretty much any information that is technical or commercial or anything that is clearly marked or identified as confidential, that is protected, and also the information needs to relate to this project, and the application of that definition is that you should keep all information that is confidential, so you don't disclose that information to anybody outside the project. But of course, there are exceptions to confidentiality. So what is not considered confidential, for example, is information that is already public beforehand, or information that needs to be disclosed, for example, according to law or a court order, or something like that. And there are also there's the section how long is the obligation in force. So I think in this case it's 3 years. So that's the time that you have to keep it confidential, and also the liability if the confidentiality is breached. So there are a certain amount that you have to pay if you breach the confidentiality. So next is background. So this is quite important in relation to research contracts, you know, scientific research. So this contract, it defines a background as material. So it defines background material as information that relates to the nature of the project, but is defined outside the project in question, and is owned by one party. So what this means is that there's some existing information that one party brings to the project, and that can be utilized during the project. So in that sense, it's important to know who owns the rights to the background and who can use it and how. So for example, one party can give out a license to the other party to use that background during the project, and for example only for project purposes. And usually these types of contracts, they do not transfer the ownership of the background to the other party. So for instance, they can be used for the use of results. So if you can't use the results without background, there's really no point in having the results. So that is something that's usually taken into account in these types of agreements. And then the results. So these are also especially relevant for scientific research. It's usually the whole point of the research to get the results. And these contracts, they define who gets the right to the results that are created during this project. And results are usually defined as pretty much any information that is created during the project. And for example, reports or other documents or perhaps inventions, pretty much anything that is intellectual property. And the main thing, of course, is who owns the results. So in this project agreement, it's the client who owns the results. And I think the contract says that the ownership is transferred to the client once they have made the payments for the project. And usually patentable inventions, those don't belong automatically to the client. So in this case, I think they belong to the students or the members of the group who made the inventions, but otherwise the client gets the exclusive rights to the results. And also this contract, it gives the project group the right to use the results in their studies and research and such. So there's some type of licensing thing here. But of course, when you use the results, there are limitations that you need to take into account. For example, like I said, you cannot disclose the confidential information. And there are some also quite detailed conditions for the use in this agreement. So you should be aware of the conditions before you use the results outside of this project. And also lastly, the educational institutions, they can use the results for the so-called learning tasks, and learning tasks are defined in this contract as tasks that need to be carried out for the students to pass the course. So the university cannot use the results for any other purposes. So a little bit about guarantee and maintenance. So in this agreement, you don't give guarantees in relation to the results, so which means that the client uses the results at their own risk. So you will not be responsible for the results if the damage arises from the use of that those results. So and also you do not commit to maintaining the results in any way. So once the results are done, you are clear of any guarantees or maintaining. And these are quite typical clauses in academic agreements. So giving guarantees could, for example, hinder doing research. But then, and this is quite important, this liabilities part. So the clauses in these contracts are quite carefully drafted and student-friendly. So this agreement tries to minimize the liability that the students would have to pay if they break the agreement. So there are three kinds of limitations to liability in this case. So firstly, there's the amount. So I think in this case, the cap for damages is 750 euros, which basically means that if you cause damage to another party, 750 euros is the maximum amount that you would have to pay to that party. So that's the cap. There are, of course, limitations to this, but I will go to those later. And the second limitation to liability is time. So any claims that arise for damages need to be presented in 6 months from the damage arising. So you can't claim damages forever. So and the third kind of limitation is the type of damages, and this relates to what kind of damage does not raise liability. So you are not liable for indirect damages in this contract. So firstly, the direct damages, they are something that they arise from breach of contract directly. So it's quite easy to see, for example, if you break something and somebody has to pay for it directly, that is a direct damage. Whereas indirect damages, they are kind of hard to foresee. They can be, for example, lost profits or interruption of production. So one way to look at this is money you had to pay, which are in direct damages, versus some money you did not receive, which are indirect damages. So in this contract, you are not liable for indirect damages arising out of the agreement. And also there's a force majeure clause in this contract. So nobody is liable for damages if something happens for an unforeseen reason. For example, there's a natural disaster or a war or a global pandemic or something, then you will not be liable as a starting point. But there are still exceptions to these liabilities. I mean, the limitations to these liabilities. So limitations do not apply if the damage was caused intentionally or due to gross negligence. So generally, you could say that if you break the law and cause damage, then you will be liable without limitations. So you will be liable for both direct and indirect damages, and also the cap that I mentioned, that doesn't apply to in that case. So you should obey the law carefully. And last thing to add is that you should pay attention to confidential information. Parties in this case are also liable for indirect damages if they breach confidentiality. So you shouldn't go spreading confidential information around either during the project. So that's pretty much all for today. I thank you for your attention. And if you have any questions or comments, I encourage you to send them to me, and I will answer them as soon as I can. So thank you.